Be afraid. Be very afraid. If you listen to most of the American media, you would get the idea that Adolf Hitler is the presumptive Republican nominee for president. Everywhere you're being told that if Donald Trump wins, it'll be the end of our democracy. George Stephanopoulos, who has no business working in news as what's supposed to be a neutral observer, opened his show that he should never have been allowed to host this week on ABC with this on Sunday.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. Until now, no American president had ever faced a criminal trial. No American president had ever faced a federal indictment for retaining and concealing classified documents. No American president had ever faced a federal indictment or a state indictment for trying to overturn an election or been named an unindicted co-conspirator in two other states for the same crime. No American president had ever faced hundreds of millions of dollars in judgments for business fraud, defamation, and sexual abuse. Until now, no American presidential race had been more defined by what's happening in courtrooms than what's happening on the campaign trail. Until now. The scale of the abnormality is so staggering that it can actually become numbing. It's all too easy to fall into reflexive habits, to treat this as a normal campaign, where both sides embrace the rule of law, where both sides are dedicated to a debate based on facts and the peaceful transfer of power. But that is not what's happening this election year. Those bedrock tenets of our democracy are being tested in a way we haven't seen since the Civil War. It's a test for the candidates, for those of us in the media, and for all of us as citizens.
What a girly man. See how this works? The side in power comes up with a bunch of bogus charges and then warns you about voting for a candidate who's been charged with so many crimes. It's unbelievable how obvious that is and how obvious the plan is. Of course, a Democrat's doing it is one thing, but a Democrat operative posing as an objective reporter or moderator is another. And now that Donald Trump is starting to pull ahead in the polls, the panic is setting in. So you can expect it to be turned up a notch. And we're going to have our media expert, Jeffrey McCall, here in the second half hour to talk about this. But when we come back, you might be surprised to find out that those college kiddies you're seeing causing trouble on campus, they learned how to do that from public school teachers paid for by you. Stick around. Well, how'd you like to be a parent paying $85,000 a year to send your kid to Columbia? And would it make you feel pretty good to know that the kids you see demonstrating around the country may have been trained how to do it in high school, paid for, of course, with your tax dollars in the public high school? Jonathan Butcher is education fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He joins us now. Thanks for coming back on, Jonathan. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So everybody knows what civics is, I think, but what's action civics?
Well, dating back some 20 years ago, as both those on the right and the left were concerned about civics education in the U.S. because scores were so low, those on the left turned to what they called action civics, which they say does away with, quote, your grandmother's civics and doesn't focus on names and dates or even processes of becoming involved in voting and electoral politics, but instead train students to be activists. In fact, there are nonprofit organizations that help schools teach, for I use that term loosely, what action civics is, and it's all about protests and walkouts. And they put this in their annual reports, these organizations do. They talk about how they led students on walkouts over gun rights, or over gender rights. And, you know, clearly the objectives and the political positions of these projects are all skewed left of center.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So how long has this been going on? You say 20 years?
I mean, it really dates back at least to the Obama administration. Arne Duncan, who was the secretary at that time of the U.S. Department of Education, he released a report describing what action civics was. But you can really find it all over today. I mean, there are school districts that have been doing it for many, many years. And, I mean, even more concerning, right, is as you look at the terms that are now being used in even regular civics, if you could call it that, are terms like decolonization or settler colonialism. And those are the same terms that are being used in these pro-Hamas or pro, terrorist protests going on at the encampments on college campuses.
So if this goes back 20 years, it's plenty of time for every kid on a college campus to have had a good chance of being having been indoctrinated with this stuff.
Well, especially in just the last four, right? I mean, after what happened in the summer of 2020, leading into 2021, I mean, you know, these were high school kids who were watching this stuff unfold on TV, and now they're, you know, old enough to be in college, right? And so they clearly saw what happened the summer of George Floyd and the riots that took place there. I think they are just living out, right, what they have been taught.
Is it everywhere? Is it, or is it more something more like a California blue state kind of thing?
I mean, I think you can find the language in California's ethnic studies in particular. You can find Action Civics in school district materials in California. I would add Minnesota as well. I think Illinois also has standards that are just full of these ideas. So, you know, I do think it's found in K-12 schools all over the country, although, you know, arguably you're going to find it a little less in some places like, you know, South Carolina and Texas. Although, you know, if you look closely at these standards, and this is kind of where it blurs the line into, quote, socio-emotional learning, right? Even as you look into SEL curriculum in states that are, you know, generally red states, you'll still find some of these ideas.
What might a, I'm trying to picture what a one of these civics action civics classes would look like, or of course, I mean, they're showing kids how to make signs, how to march in a protest. What do they spend their time doing?
Yeah, they literally are doing that. There's a report from an action civics group called the Mikvah Challenge, and they highlight student projects out of Chicago. Students doing action civics work. And it really was. I mean, students literally made protest signs and conducted a walkout. And they were essentially honored for doing so, right? They were recognized for staging a walkout out of class to engage in a protest.
And does this mean that the kids doing this demonstrating have a good working knowledge of how American government works?
Well, I mean, that's what I think we're starting to see at Columbia and elsewhere. You know, there's this clip that's been floating online of a young lady who went from Columbia to NYU take part in a riot there, and she was asked by a reporter why she was doing it, and she couldn't explain it and had to turn around and ask the person next to her why they were there. I mean, look, clearly, right, I mean, some of these, you know, most of these folks have pro-Palestine or, you know, whatever, Hamas garb. Many of them are wearing masks, which is, you know, that should be concerning in, you know, in its own right. But, I mean, I think that you can see kind of the general cause appears to have something to do with Palestine. But, you know, I don't believe that students have enough understanding, certainly not of what it takes to be civilized, right, in civil society. But I don't think they can explain the details of what's going on in Gaza to understand the details.
Well, I've seen enough person on the street interviews with college age kids and many of them done on college campuses. And yeah, I'm sure you've seen them where they'll ask a bunch of kids who won the Civil War. And they'll say Russia. It's just that they have zero clue. They'll ask them who the vice president of the United States is today, and they don't know the answer. How does one kid get out of high school not knowing the simple things that you should know in civics? But they obviously do. I'm talking about there are kids who don't know how many states there are.
Yeah, I mean, Jay Leno had a whole routine that he used to do where he would do, you know, these man on the street interviews. Yeah, I mean, I think for one, it demonstrates that there really is an utter lack of kind of knowledge transformation among social studies teachers. I think social studies has become a watered down version of history, and I don't think that it effectively teaches history. I think, you know, the good news is, as you look at some states, and I would point to Louisiana, South Dakota in particular, they have updated their social studies standards in recent years, and they are very strong when it comes to facts, names, and dates. And so I think that there is there are a set of state superintendents of education out there today conscious of this problem and are taking advantage of their role of having to update state standards to make these standards more rigorous. But clearly, you know, it's going to be, you know, at least a year, if not more, of students taking these classes before we can see an effect.
Now, you mentioned that this goes back to the Obama administration. So I guess nobody should be surprised that our former community organizer in chief was a big fan of this.
Well, sure. And I think, you know, the conversation about critical race theory and the 1619 Project, even, you know, going back to 2020, 2019, it all has a piece in this, right? I mean, the teachers have been reading Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is a, you know, a Marxist handbook, effectively, in colleges of education for many, many years, right, even before the Obama administration. So I think these ideas of critical race theory, which is based on, you know, these ideas of decolonization, of settler colonialism, of oppressor versus oppressed mindset, all of those concepts, right, this kind of neo-Marxism, it's all embedded in critical race theory. And that, you know, that's been, you know, that's now, you know, birthday is probably late 80s, right? Or, you know, certainly before the 90s. So teachers have had this material kind of percolating in colleges of education well through the 1990s.
What is that, again, that you went by me pretty fast with that? I wasn't aware of that. This is a plan that or a format that education majors are taught, or teachers who, people who are already teachers are drilled with this?
Yeah, I mean, so as you look at, you know, critical race theory, which people became more familiar with over the past, you know, couple of years, that is a Marxist philosophy based on the idea that race defines everything around us. Well, it has found its way into colleges of education, right? They call it, sometimes it's critical pedagogy is typically what it's referred to, but it's critical, right? Because it's looking at pedagogy or teaching from the perspective of race as the driving factor. And it's been taught in colleges of education for, I mean, going on three decades, you know, probably at least two and a half decades, I would say. And it has all the same ideas in it that we're seeing in Action Civics, right? I mean, decolonization, intersectionality, right? All of these terms that come out of the critical race theory canon are all in there.
We're talking to Jonathan Butcher. He's education fellow at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about something called Action Civics, which is, it's the first I've heard of it. I haven't had kids in school for a long time. But I'm just wondering, Jonathan, how aware would parents be of this, do you suppose? If you see Action Civics and you're not paying close attention, that sounds like a pretty innocuous title, or maybe even something that sounds pretty good for your kid.
Well, sure. And those who advocate for it, they'll describe it as sort of democracy on wheels, or, you know, the future of teaching civic education, because it makes students apply the ideas of civic learning. But, you know, the trouble is that these kids are 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and they're not old enough, unless they have been deeply schooled, right, in the history of the Roman Republic and, you know, democracy coming out of Greece and then our founding fathers, to understand how to apply civic education, which they're clearly not. Because when you look at the scores, right, of students on history tests and national comparisons and civics tests, these scores are dismal and have been for a long time. And so I would argue that those on the left have sort of skipped over teaching it. We're not going to teach civics anymore. We're just going to ask students to go and become politically active. And that's very, very dangerous, right, because they don't understand the implications of what they're advocating for.
And I'm guessing that when they're having these walkouts or when they're talking about action civics and, you know, taking an active role in demonstrating and doing all that, there aren't too many practice demonstrations that involve, I don't know, school choice or lowering the income tax, you know, demonstrating against taxes being too high. I'm guessing you don't see too many of those.
No, I haven't heard much of that, although I did find examples of action civics where students are trained to promote unionization and for people to join public sector unions. Mm-hmm. I found some about students creating a documentary in favor of, quote, gender rights.
Yeah, right.
As gun laws are often, you know, an object of scorn. And then, you know, you're seeing, I think, even, you know, even as you look back now, a lot of pro-Palestine material in action civics. And again, I think we can't overlook or miss, right, the use of words like decolonization and imperialism and settler colonialism, because those are the terms that are being used by the people in camping now on college campuses, right? These are the concepts that they're applying.
And the scary thing is that according to the headline, at least, of your piece, it says K-12 action civics. How early are they starting these kids with this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, there are examples going into elementary school. I mean, I think increasingly, right, young people are being taught about, quote, climate change, which used to be global warming until we realized it wasn't all warming. You know,
right.
They can't seem to decide what it is exactly. But, yeah, I mean, you can teach, you know, young people that there is something to be righteously indignant about, right? I mean, that's all you have to give a young child is a reason to be indignant about something. And, you know, the facts kind of come later, if at all. And they just, if they have something to feel like there's an injustice done, it doesn't matter how it's described, you know, young students will use their energies, right, towards that, because they're high on the energy scale, right, but kind of low on the experience scale. And that's what education is supposed to do, right? It is supposed to provide students with the experience and the knowledge that will help them become productive citizens, right? To become civilized. That's the whole point. And action civics skips over that. They're not teaching people to be civilized. They're teaching them to be radical.
Yeah, we're talking to Jonathan Butcher. He's an education fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Before we go, I got about a minute and a half left here, Jonathan. I want to ask you about one other thing. You wrote about this not too long ago, too. The new Title IX regulations and the fact that the Biden administration has redefined sex. What's that going to, in your headline of your piece there says, what does that mean for school? So what does it mean? If you got about a minute to explain that.
Yeah, sure. For educators, they should pause. They should not change their school policies right now, because it's already wound up in court. There have been at least three lawsuits against the change to this rule that, you know, redefines sex to mean, quote, gender, and puts women in particular in danger. So schools should they should wait. They should not be changing their policies, because this is going to wind up in court. And I think it certainly should not stand.
Did you see what happened in West Virginia?
Yes, the young women
yeah.
who could not compete, they were now banned from competing.
Yeah, these girls.
They refused to.
Yeah, just for a real quick recap, the girls in West Virginia elementary school, there was a shot put competition, and the opposing team, or one of the opposing teams, had a boy on the team. So they stepped into the circle and then walked out and refused to compete. And they have now been banned, I guess, by the local athletic association in West Virginia, for having stepped out.
No, it's such a shame. Such a shame.
It's sick. Well, I'm hoping to get somebody from the Independent Women's Forum on to talk about that, because they're one of the groups suing over this. So, Jonathan, I always appreciate having you on. Great stuff you write at the Heritage Foundation on education. Hope to have you on again soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, that's Jonathan Butcher, Heritage Foundation. You can find him at dailysignal.com. You can find his piece. I'll be right back. If a demonstration broke out on a college campus and the TV news didn't show up to cover it, would anybody know it happened? If you're a news producer, you love a good campus uprising. It's great TV. It's theater. And the people doing the uprising can count on getting the message out. Jeffrey McCall is a professor of communications at DePauw University. He's also a media critic for The Hill. And he joins us now. And always good to have you on, Jeff. Thanks for coming back.
And thank you, John.
So what's been your overall opinion of how the media have covered the demonstration so far? I'm sure you've been paying attention.
Well, I've been trying to watch it very carefully, and I must say I'm concerned that the presence of the television cameras is really a fact in the growth of these demonstrations. And I know the media needs to be there to cover these events, but at a certain point, I think the media becomes a participant in these events or maybe a catalyst to encourage these kinds of demonstrations. And when you get right down to it, that what these demonstrators or activists most want is attention and visibility.
Right.
And that is happening through television news. And the social media, of course, is part of that as well. But a lot of this is happening through journalistic activism in itself. And the question I have is, are these journalists really trying to cover these events? Or are they trying to help promote or stir up these events? And I think that that's a problem. And I wish executive producers at these major TV outlets would maybe think twice about just letting all this coverage just go unfiltered, because I mean, you notice that they bring on these student activists and interview them, and they're letting these people spout all kinds of like crazy notions without challenging them. And I think that's part of the problem here is we're letting these people think, you know, engage in outrage. We're letting them kind of have their 2 cents worth, but maybe it's not in the best interest of trying to manage the situation. And I think that's the thing here is, you know, even when the police move in, they've got to worry about what the optics are going to look like, you know, if they happen to pick somebody up or they try to keep somebody from throwing a bottle or something like that. Because you know that the editors and producers are going to mischaracterize, or they're only going to show the most, you know, extreme or in sensational kinds of perspectives. And that's not helpful generally for us to be able to understand what's going on. And I think that's the big thing here. How can we report on these things and most help the average American understand what's going on these college campuses? And that's really hard to do with television and students shouting or being interviewed and giving unhinged kind of diatribes out there. I'm not saying the media should not cover it, but I think we should maybe consider how much we cover, whether we do saturation coverage, and also what kind of coverage, that maybe it'd be best to try to cover this stuff without video cameras that clearly attract these students kind of like flies to a light. You know, they want to get there. They want to get in front because it's their show. And that's really part of their strategy here is to make a show.
Sure, and if you set something on fire, then you're going to get a few extra cameras.
Yeah, and that just and the media is the reason for that. I mean,
yeah.
Let's think about that. You're an activist. You want to show how mad you are. You want to get a lot of attention to yourself. If you're standing silently on a street corner, or you're just standing and holding a sign, or something like that, or even sitting in a tent. You know, there's a certain point where there's like no quote unquote news value to that.
Mm-hmm.
But once you block a street, once you start something on fire, once you break down the door of an administration building, you have created quote unquote news, which is going to get all kinds of sensational coverage. and we then end up with news organizations becoming players in the demonstrations rather than observers and reporters of the demonstrations.
And I mean, what do you think how common do you think it is that there would be anybody working at a major news outlet, TV news outlet, who would see this going on and say, listen, we're going to cover this, but let's tone it down. I don't want too many cameras over there. I just can't imagine any news outlet taking that attitude. I think they look
probably
at it
not.
This is theater, and we're gonna have some fun with this.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I'd characterize it as fun, but they're going to exploit the situation for its news, quote-unquote news value and its sensational value. And my sense is there are probably very few people in the newsroom who would say, let's be careful, let's be guarded here, because they would then be accused of trying to cover up the news or trying to hold back the news or censor the news and removing the opportunity of the activists to have their say. And I think that's a fear probably in a lot of these newsrooms, particularly the more left-leaning ones, is that if somebody were to go in and say, I'm not sure we need to be putting these student activists on TV live. I'm not sure we need to be listing all of their demands. Somebody would say, oh, you're trying to restrict the news, or you're trying to censor these people from their First Amendment rights. And of course, that would be very damning in a newsroom like at CNN or someplace like that.
Saw Lawrence Jones of Fox this morning. He was interviewing someone. I forget which campus it was. I don't remember which one. I think it was Columbia. But anyway, somewhere they kind of kidnapped, maybe too strong a word, but they had a janitor or a maintenance guy, and he was kind of bottled up, and they wouldn't let him out. And so Lawrence Jones was asking them about that, about this guy being, you know, just kind of restrained. And the woman who was being interviewed said, well, I think that's a mischaracterization. She wouldn't go along with it. And then he asked her, because you're talking about asking them questions and getting them to talk about this stuff. This was a pro-Palestine person. And he said, what about October 7th and the rapes? And the woman walked away. And when he kind of followed her a little bit and asked her again, she said, get out of my face, please. She wouldn't talk about it.
Well, she's restricting the flow of information herself, I suppose. And I mean, she's acting like a propagandist would, where they're not interested in covering all the nuance and all the context of any particular story. And I think that's something that is missing from a lot of the media coverage of these protests, is that they're not trying to put into context here what the greater issues are. And the greater issues are that, you know, there are concerns geopolitically with regard to Palestine and Israel and that sort of thing. But, you know, you don't see a lot of discussion in the coverage of these protests about Hamas as a terrorist organization and what Hamas did and continues to do, which has sparked the Israelis into action. There's only been a focus on what the Israeli military has done, the casualties in Gaza, and that sort of thing. And I'm not saying that's not part of the news, but I am saying there needs to be a broader context here. And I must say, I'm disturbed oftentimes when I see that the news organizations are quoting, you know, data or statistics or points of view from the Palestinian authority as though that information can be taken with a straight face. I mean, they always come on and say, oh, the Palestinian Authority says X number of people have been injured or killed or whatever, and X percent of them are children. I'm thinking they probably really don't know that. And to be reporting information from a source that clearly is biased and probably inaccurate comes off as not very sensible reporting when you get right down to it.
How different, Jeff, do you think the coverage might be if the agitators were siding with, say, groups that advocate killing all blacks instead of all Jews? You think it might be a little different?
Well, it'd be entirely different if it were almost any other organization. Yeah. And I think that's one of the weirdest things about this whole thing is these activists are engaging in some really questionable slash offensive, you know, slash inaccurate accusations and behaviors regarding to what's happening over in the Middle East. And my guess is most of these activists don't even really know what's happening on the ground over in the Middle East anyway. But certainly they're giving them much more of a voice than if these people were criticizing, you know, not basically any other ethnic or demographic group.
Yeah, well, they're
and I don't understand that, because, I mean, when you get right down to it, you know, the news organizations should be interested in the rights and interests of all different groups of people and all different demographics, and whether or not there's oppression or fairness in coverage. And the fact that they are seemingly insensitive to the plight of the Israelis and the Jewish people, not only in Israel, but also in the United States, where Jewish students at schools, you know, are in fear of their own safety on their own college campuses. And that seems to like not be important to most of the news coverage that you see coming out of places like CNN or MSNBC.
And they're covering organizations that have made it clear that the goal is to eliminate all Jews, kill all the Jews. That's Hamas. If they're out there flying on a Hamas flag, it's like the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, and I must say, covering this kind of social unrest is really challenging for journalists. So I don't want to make it look like I've got all the answers or
right.
This is a simple thing to solve, because covering something this complex with video is really hard to do, because video doesn't provide for much nuance. As I've said before, television is a medium of emotion, not a medium for thinking. And so we cover this with TV and video and social media, you know, snippets and that sort of thing. It's no wonder people can't piece together what the bigger issues are. But having said all that, that's why we have professional journalists, so that they can make professional decisions and they can use their head and help provide managed and rational coverage. And I must say, for the most part, that's not happening.
In the show open, on another subject now, I played a clip from George Stephanopoulos. He did a commentary to open this week, his show that he hosts on Sunday. I'll play it again now to get your reaction. Here it is.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. Until now, no American president had ever faced a criminal trial. No American president had ever faced a federal indictment for retaining and concealing classified documents. No American president had ever faced a federal indictment or a state indictment for trying to overturn an election or been named an unindicted co-conspirator in two other states for the same crime. No American president ever faced hundreds of millions of dollars in judgments for business fraud, defamation, and sexual abuse. Until now, no American presidential race had been more defined by what's happening in courtrooms than what's happening on the campaign trail. Until now. The scale of the abnormality is so staggering that it can actually become numbing. It's all too easy to fall into reflexive habits, to treat this as a normal campaign, where both sides embrace the rule of law, where both sides are dedicated to a debate based on facts and the peaceful transfer of power. But that is not what's happening this election year. Those bedrock tenets of our democracy are being tested in a way we haven't seen since the Civil War. It's a test for the candidates, for those of us in the media, and for all of us as citizens.
Now, I wouldn't watch that show if I were in solitary confinement and they let me out, you know, for the first time in 60 days just to give me something to watch. But that is that's a pretty important show that he's on. And I don't know about you, Jeff, but I don't think he does a commentary to open every show. So he must be feeling pretty strongly about this.
Well, he does feel pretty strongly about this. And I must say that this is an opinion that he's expressing here that is sorely lacking in context. Because, I mean, he's right in one regard that no American former president has ever faced these kind of indictments. But he seems to be uninterested in what the circumstances are that led to all these kinds of court procedures and whatnot. And so it's clear that George Stephanopoulos for many years has been an activist journalist. I don't think anybody with a straight face could say that he's at all trying to be objective or fair. And interestingly, he's talking about, you know, the rule of law and all these kinds of corruptions and abnormalities. And I would say you might keep in mind the abnormalities of the person he served for in the White House when he was a key political operative in the Clinton administration, because you talk about abnormalities. The Clinton administration had any number of different things.
Yep.
But when he went out of office, people were glad to have it over with. And, you know, the Bush administration came in and ignored what Clinton had done. And we have a case now where Trump went out of office, and the people who came into power at that point in the White House and the Justice Department were unwilling to kind of let things just drop. And I must say this, I'm always upset and think that people just don't understand history at all. And Stephanopoulos would be one of these guys, I think, does not understand history. You know, but to be saying that, you know, our country's at more risk now than at any time since the Civil War, that is an overstatement that to me is purely Chicken Little kind of, you know, screaming at the sky
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff to kind of create emotion and to get people all stirred up. in ways that really are not supported by the history. I mean, if you're worried about, you know, the nation and its various struggles, I mean, sure, the nation has struggles now. But to say that the nation is more at risk than during World War II or during the Great Depression or when, you know, the Soviets had missiles pointing at us from Cuba, I mean, it just shows to me a stunning lack of context and nuance. But it's all being done for political effect and political theater now because he wants to show off. And, you know, I'd like to think that a guy like Stephanopoulos just doesn't have that much sway in the public sphere. But, you know, when you give a guy on a major network his own hour every week to propagandize and to do commentary like this, you know, there are bound to be people out there who are going to buy what he has to say. And I think that's unfortunate.
Yeah, well, I'm out of time. I got about 30 seconds here. But, you know, how about not giving it to the Democrat equivalent of Karl Rove to be hosting your political show? That's who he is.
Yeah, or maybe even somebody like Stephen Miller from the Trump administration. So it's clearly not fair, and ABC should not be labeling him as a journalist. I mean, if they want to have him do commentary, they'd say, hey, he's a commentator. But to say that he's an anchor and a news journalist, I think, is really misleading to the American public.
Hey, it's always good to have you on, Jeff. I'm sure we'll have you on again soon.
Thank you, John.
Okay, thank you very much. That's Jeff McCall, and he's a professor of communications at DePauw University. I'll be right back. Well, maybe you remember the story we had a few weeks ago about five middle school girls in West Virginia who did the right thing when the track team that they were supposed to compete against showed up with a boy posing as a girl to throw the shot put. And they stepped into the circle as though they were going to throw the shot put, and then they stepped out without doing it. So they forfeited, and they were praised everywhere for doing what they should do, which is what every single girl or woman who faces this should do, just absolutely refuse to compete. So they didn't compete, and this person named Becky Pepper Jackson, who was a male, but has been acting as a girl since she was like 8 years old. He was 8 years old. He won the shot put competition by 3 feet. Now, I don't know how things go in a girl's middle school shot put competition. I don't know if, you know, the winner wins by a few inches, but I'm going to guess that 3 feet's a big win and just blew everybody else away. So what's happened now is that whatever the regulating body down there is in West Virginia for sports has banned the five girls from being able to compete. They were hoping to compete in a track meet this coming weekend, I think it is, and they were told they can't because of what they did. And a couple of stories I'm reading here, and I can't get this straight after going through several of these, but I'm getting this impression that their own coach, because Riley Gaines, who I'm sure you're familiar with, has been speaking out about this stuff, she said that their own coach banned them from playing. So it stinks. And the attorney general in West Virginia is going to try to take it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Let's hope he wins. I'll talk to you tomorrow.